Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has been an advocate for the quiet competency and thoughtfulness of introverts. Since the publication of her 2012 book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, and her TED Talk that has had over 13 million views, Susan Cain has been struck by the number of people who have said, I wish I knew this when I was growing up. That's been the focus of The Quiet Revolution, a nonprofit she has founded as a resource for kids, their parents, and teachers, and the focus for her follow-up book, which is designed specifically towards introverted kids. Quiet Power, The Secret Strengths of Introverts, help introverts negotiate and navigate school, extracurricular activities, and friendships, environments that traditionally reward extroverted behavior. But most importantly, to reassure these kids that there's nothing wrong with the need for quiet or alone time and coping tips for handling social situations outside of their comfort zone. Susan Cain joins us today here on Studio Tulsa to talk about her most recent book, Quiet Power. Susan Cain, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
So great to be here.
Take us back to the beginning. Now, as an introvert yourself, to be now considered the spokesperson for introverts, that must have been a difficult decision. What made you decide to start talking about your experience as an introvert and how our sort of institutions today create these barriers for introverts contributing to a business setting or especially in education circles, the circles they need to succeed? What made you begin speaking out about this?
Well, this was just something I had been thinking about all my life, you know, really from the time I was probably about 4 years old. Of course, back then, when I was a little kid, I didn't have the vocabulary introvert, extrovert. I don't actually think I came across that vocabulary until I was in my 30s. But I think most introverted kids feel very acutely the expectation that they're supposed to be more group-oriented, more extroverted than they naturally are, that they prefer to be spending their time in ways that they're continually sort of told, no, don't do that, do this other thing instead. You know, like, don't be over there drawing or playing quietly with your friend. Instead, you know, come and join the circle.
I think a lot of times that behavior is, what's wrong?
Exactly. And throughout my life, I saw it, you know, much later on when I became, I actually practiced corporate law for almost a decade, and I looked around and observed that many, not all, but many of the really good lawyers in my firm were much more quiet and cerebral and thoughtful and deliberate, you know, in their approach, and that that approach stood them really well. And then, you know, you look around at society and you see that so many of the people who have contributed in all kinds of ways, from, you know, Rosa Parks to Bill Gates, were people of very quiet, thoughtful temperament, who and that temperament was serving them well and helping them make those contributions. So it was like it all didn't add up. Here you had all these introverts who, when they draw on their natural strengths, are great people, capable of doing great things, and then here, on the other hand, you have a culture telling them, don't be you, be somebody else instead.
Yeah, speak out. Speak up. And, of course, you in your TED Talk and in both of these books, you've always related the story of going to camp and bringing a suitcase full of books, expecting to curl up with a book all summer in a natural setting. And, you know, it was camp.
Yeah, exactly. I do think there's something about camp that's kind of like the, you know, epitome of the extrovert culture, because it's so group-oriented, and it's so much like doing kind of hyped-up things for its own sake, you know, like, let's all get together and sing a song, you know, like that. Not other aspect of camp I really liked, so I don't mean to pick unfairly on camp. It's just a place where you kind of see all this in stark relief. But yeah, you know, I just started to think, gosh, this just doesn't add up. And then, you know, you start looking at the literature, and there's all kinds of interesting data showing that introverted leaders often deliver better outcomes than extroverted leaders do, while at the same time, it's usually the extroverts who are groomed for leadership positions. So there's just a lot of crazy stuff that I thought, you know, we should get people talking about this.
Yeah, and of course, the first book was Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. This new book is actually geared towards young people, Quiet Power, and really sort of relating your story in a way that would relate to kids that are sort of introverts. You sort of explain what that means. I think I've never heard this term, ambivert, I guess. which yes. I assume that's introverts or people that have a little bit of both sides.
Exactly.
Who've learned to compensate, you know, because a lot of introverts have learned to compensate, and they have to compensate because they've had a school system. They've oftentimes work environments that sort of rewards extroverted behavior. I think you touched on it a moment ago, leadership, you know, that sort of nebulous term.
Right, right. And, you know, I mean, it is worth saying that all of us, including extroverts, we all have to sometimes step outside our comfort zone. You know, you could call it compensating, you could call it being outside your comfort zone. We all need to do that some of the time to accomplish our goals in life. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But I'm making a distinction between that and between the kind of deeper, more persistent feeling that you should just be a different person altogether. Which is very different from saying, okay, you know, I want to accomplish this goal, so I'm going to go give a speech. Or if you're an extrovert, I want to accomplish this goal, so I'm going to, like, lock the door to my office and really sit and focus and get this draft done. So, okay, we all need to do that. That's okay. But, yeah, you know, when it comes to kids, I really wanted to do this book because when I first published Quiet, well, ever since I've published Quiet, I've been getting so many letters from people telling me, if only I had had this book when I was a child, my whole life could have been different. Because there's you have no idea how many people there are growing up with the idea that they should turn themselves inside out and how damaging that can be to your natural strength. So I really wanted to get to kids when they were young and, you know, talk to them about their experiences in the school cafeteria and with their friends and in class, with class participation, you know, all the questions that come up for younger people.
Well, I think a lot of the things that you describe in the book, you know, sort of the rite of passage of a new school, going to lunch, and the sort of tribalism of lunch table at an elementary school or a junior high school, those are difficult for everyone to negotiate, but I assume it's a little more difficult for introverts.
Yeah, so you're right. It's difficult for everybody. What's harder for introverts is that, you know, if you're an introvert, that kind of by definition, you want to have a lot of time to recharge either by yourself or with one or two close friends. And school is not structured that way, and adolescent social life is often not structured that way. You know, it's structured much more tribally, as you say. And so you're just never really in the setting that you want to be in. You know, there's a feeling you should be more outgoing and more gregarious in the sense of literally, like, wanting to knock around with groups of people. So that's what's tricky for an introvert, that, you know, later in life, there's so many different ways, so many different currencies, so many different ways to contribute to the culture. But when you're that age, so much of it has to do with your belonging in these social groups.
Yeah, popularity and everything that goes with that. And I think for introverts, it would be one of two paths. Either you become a follower or you become a loner.
Right. And many introverts are not followers. They really don't want to be a follower. So they may not necessarily want to be a leader, but they don't want to be a follower. And by the way, and they don't really any more than anybody else want to be loners. You know, they usually prefer instead to have the friends who they would like to have and be free to socialize with those friends.
Do they tend to seek out other introverts, or do they find maybe one extrovert that sort of gets them?
Yeah, it goes both ways. Just mm-hmm. as, you know, you could ask the same question of extroverts and the same thing would be true. You see many introverts and extroverts who are kind of attracted to each other. They complement each other. There's a kind of yin-yang feeling that they may not even be aware of consciously, but it's part of what draws them together. So you see a lot of those friendships. And then you see others where, you know, it's two extroverts who want to get crazy together or two introverts who want to, like, sit and write plays together. So, you know, you see all different variations.
Now, one of the things that the book points out is how our classrooms have changed from a couple generations ago, where basically you sat at your own desk, you did your own work. Now, today's classroom is all about cooperation. It's all about group projects because businesses said we need people who work well together. And I'm wondering, it's sort of a chicken and egg. Where did this begin? Did it begin in education, or did it begin in the corporate world where group work is more important, and there are challenges for introverts in those settings?
Well, it began more in the corporate world, but the thing is that in the corporate world, though there are more group settings than there used to be, it's still not the same. It's not as pervasive as the way that plays out in the classroom. Because if you think about it, when you're in a work setting, you know, in many different workplaces, people are kind of, just by design, they're sort of off doing their own thing. You know, one person's going off to a client meeting and another person's going to, you know, draft up a memo or whatever it is. It's not kind of in your face together all day long. So, but what's happened in the classroom is that classrooms have said, okay, or education has said, well, now we need to turn out kids who can thrive in the corporate world, and therefore they have to be team players. But team play in the classroom is like, it's 30 kids like sitting in a classroom together all day long looking at each other, you know, and doing everything together in ways that are not necessarily natural or conducive to the actual project at hand.
You're also
doing math together or writing a story together, and that's not actually really the way it's best done.
You're also looking at a maturity level, which is win-lose.
Yes, that is such a good point. I mean, I guess I'd say I've seen it both ways. Like, I've seen some group projects, because I've spent some time just sitting in classrooms observing, and you see group projects that are handled really well, and everybody's got their role, and you know, the kids treat each other respectfully. And then you see others where it's Lord of the Flies, and it's just not good.
Now, a good part of the book is talked about negotiating the classrooms, and teachers, a lot of teachers are not really... They're trying to be helpful to introverts, but they're probably doing it in a way that's increasing anxiety among introverts. I'm thinking of, say, you're having a class discussion. The introverts are holding back. They're thinking about it and perhaps excelling on the examinations of the material, but they're not contributing in class discussions. And a lot of times teachers immediately focus on those folks and try to get those people to speak out, which is the number one thing they don't want to do without thinking about it and without the proper context. How can teachers do better at bringing out those introverts without playing on those greatest fears?
Yeah, it's a great question. And because of questions like this, I should say, we have actually started a Quiet Schools Network where we're working with educators from schools all over the country who are interested in the subject to really give them the tools and techniques that they need to work with the quieter kids in their classroom. So it's really exciting. We're starting out with our first cohort of 50 educators this June. We're going to be working with them all year long, and we ultimately intend to be in every school in the country. But, you know, a lot of it is just kind of for the educators understanding what temperament really is and then having some tools and techniques. So, for example, the think, pair, share technique is something a lot of teachers are familiar with but may or may not use. It's a technique where you pose a question to the kids in the class, you ask them to think about the answer to the question individually, then you have them pair up with a partner to talk about their answer. So it's this one-on-one, which works well for introverts as well as extroverts. And then you invite the pairs, if they wish to share it out with the group. And what often happens for the introverts, they've now had the time they needed to process on their own. They've had the experience of articulating their thoughts out loud to just one partner. So at that point, they're actually more likely to want to share out with the larger group than they would have been otherwise. And even if they don't want to, they've already now had the experience of really thinking and articulating their ideas. So it's great for everybody.
There's another one in the book. It's called Think Time in the Classroom. Because somebody apparently timed a teacher from posing a question to asking for an answer. I think the lapse was basically 1 second.
Yes. And so what happens is you get, by definition, it's the extroverts who like to think out loud who are the ones who answer it with such a short gap of time. Whereas, yeah, the studies show if the teachers wait, you know, 5 beats, 6 beats, 7 beats before calling on somebody, you get the kids who want to think and process before they raise their hand. And so you get a lot more kids participating just by waiting those extra beats.
One of the things this gets us into another sort of situation of leadership, and you know, schools are about they're about helping develop leadership, and leadership a lot of times in schools goes to the extroverts, the people who are really outer directed, and I'm wondering how that translates when we start thinking of some of these introverted techniques and getting the more quiet, studious folks who are really processing and taking time to process. Because, you know, in a business setting, a good extroverted leader has some really important people to them, the introverts who are sort of thinking and processing, and you're always bouncing ideas off those folks.
That's true. But also, important to know that in the business world, studies suggest that it's the introverted leaders who often deliver the best outcomes. So I don't think we should be thinking of leadership as, oh, you know, it's the extroverts who are the leaders drawing on the strengths of the introverts. It is sometimes like that, but it can be the reverse as well.
But don't schools sort of, the leadership positions are usually those types of, those extroverted type of individuals?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason for that, I think what happens is we are defining leadership too narrowly within schools. So kids assume, oh, to be a leader, that means I've got to be a president of the school class, or I've got to be, you know, head of the school paper, but I don't really want to be, like, I'm not ready for that at this stage of my life to be in charge of that many people. And I think we should be defining leadership much more broadly than that. Leadership is also about thought leadership or about being passionate in an area and advancing that area, whatever it happens to be, because there's a real problem of schools nowadays emphasizing leadership almost above everything else, and then half the kids feeling like, that's not who I am. You know, in the book, we profiled examples of kids who did succeed in these more conventional modes of leadership, who were quite introverted. Like one guy by the name of Davis Wynn, who by his own description was very shy and nerdy in high school and decided he was going to run for class president. And he was running against one of the most popular girls in school. And he drew on his strengths as an introvert and really thought deeply about what was wrong with the school and what he could do to help make it better. And he ran a campaign platform that was deep and thoughtful and substantive against this girl who was basically proposing to have more parties. And he won. He won, and he became the president. And he then went on to Yale and is now a college grad and has kind of used this technique all his life of digging deep and getting to know people based on what he could contribute, offer to them substantively. And I think it's really worth pointing out these examples so that these kids realize, figure out what your strengths are. You know, you don't have to have the social butterfly strengths, because there are a lot of other ones out there on offer. What are yours?
My guest today is Susan Cain, author of Quiet Power, The Secret Strengths of Introverts, which is a book for young people, and sort of explaining, if you're an introvert, sort of a guide of negotiating school and also advocating for yourself. You have a lot of examples of kids that have gone to teachers, especially teachers that have put these kids in stressful positions and sort of advocated for themselves. And I think that's one of the things your book does. It's about advocating for yourself and figuring out ways that you can contribute more in the classroom and sort of in a less threatening way to the kids themselves.
Yeah, that's right. And that looks different for different kids. You know, so we talk with some kids where for them what really works is preparing in advance before class and then giving themselves a push to speak up early in the class before the anticipatory anxiety of not having contributed builds up. And then for other kids, they feel much more comfortable when they wait a while and see what other kids have said and, you know, perhaps build on the comments of the kids who have gone before them. So a lot of this is about feeling mindful and self-aware of what works for you, feeling entitled to do it your way, and that it's okay if you have to be a little more deliberate about it. It often appears in class as if, oh, all the other kids are just spontaneously throwing up their hands. They don't even need to think about it. And maybe that's true for some of them, and maybe it's not, but it kind of doesn't matter. If you need to do it your way, do it your way.
Hmm. Let's talk about one of the big issues that I know introverts always have to face in the classroom, and that is the public speaking or classroom speaking. What are some good hints to help parents and teachers negotiate that better for introverts?
Yeah, okay. This is a really big one because this is a place, an arena, where you have the chance to potentially really set a kid back or potentially to really open them up and unleash their potential. So very important to understand, if you think of anxiety levels on a scale of 1 to 10, you should not be asking kids to give a speech or really do anything, but let's say give a speech when they're at the anxiety level, like of the 8 to 10 range. You just don't want to do that because there's too big a chance that it could backfire, not go well, and then it's going to make it that much harder for them the next time around. And there are documented neurobiological reasons that it becomes harder and harder if you have that kind of backfired event. On the other hand, you do want them to stretch outside their comfort zone, but the trick is to give them the exercises that are right for them and understand that for the kids in your class, they're all going to be at different ranges of how anxious public speaking makes them. So for some kids, they will be able to just get up and rattle off a speech to their classmates from the get-go. But for others, they might be better served by maybe practicing the speech just with a teacher or just with one friend. And then from there, maybe building up to a smaller group. And from there, a slightly larger group. And so on until they become more and more comfortable. So they're doing it in small, manageable stages where at each stage they're in that kind of 4 to 6 level of stepping outside their comfort zone.
Yeah. I know so often we tend to say you're going to learn to swim by throwing you in the pool. And, of course, for some people that works and the kids start swimming, and others you have to pull them out and then never go swimming again.
Yes. No, that's exactly right. And yeah, I mean, for the success stories, it's amazing. Absolutely. I don't want to take away from those stories. I just believe it's too much of a risk for the kids for whom it doesn't work. And this isn't just, I made it sound like this is just my belief. There's actually an entire field of psychology that is premised on this idea that the way to overcome any fear is by desensitizing yourself to it in small, manageable steps. So this is exactly the approach I took to overcome my own fear of public speaking, which I used to be terrified of, and now I go around and speak all over the world and don't even give it a second thought. But I did it in this very slow, deliberate way.
Can you talk about the overcoming that fear? Because I imagine as an introvert, it was really difficult. I mean, you kind of went a power route, you know, Princeton, Harvard Law School. You were expected to speak up probably all the time in those settings. How did you negotiate that?
Yeah, and I should say I had a terrible, terrible fear of it, partly because of experiences that I had when I was in middle school. You know, when I was going through my most self-conscious years and was put in situations that were too much for me, that backfired, you know, just the way I was talking about, and then later was fascinated to learn kind of what the neurobiology was that encoded that fear so deeply. But yeah, in my case, it was encoded, and so I got through Princeton and Harvard Law School and practiced in corporate law for 10 years. I kind of gritted my teeth through every public speaking experience and really suffered. It used to be that I could do it but just because I kind of had the discipline to grit my way through it. But before every speech, I would lose 5 pounds and not be able to sleep the night before. You know, it was really intense. And then I was publishing this book, Quiet, and I really wanted to overcome the fear because I didn't want anything standing between me and the ability to get these ideas out. So I embarked on what I called my year of speaking dangerously, where I practiced public speaking in exactly the way I'm now recommending to teachers. You know, I did it really slowly. I signed up for a workshop for people who were uncomfortable with public speaking, where we just had to do a little bit more each week. I joined Toastmasters, which, for those who don't know, is it's a worldwide organization, and you can just sign up for your local chapter, and you meet once a week or so and practice public speaking in this very supportive, safe environment where it doesn't matter if you screw up because you're just practicing. And little by little, I just got over the fear, you know, so I ended up giving a TED Talk.
Now, was there any special fear attached to that TED Talk because
God,
it was going to be recorded?
Oh, my gosh, yes. First of all, I wasn't totally over my fear by then anyway. And, you know, on top of that, it's TED, and you know that millions of people might watch it, and, you know the audience is full of Bill Gates is sitting there and all kinds of other people. So it was very scary. But the great irony after you give a TED Talk is people start inviting you to give speeches all over the world. And it was through that process I really just started to lose the fear, you know, almost completely, because it just became something I was so used to doing. So now I should say, too, I really learned how to shift my focus from fear of being judged to passion for what I wanted to communicate. And I think that's the real mind shift with public speaking.
Yeah. And of course, I know that's your definition of the difference between introversion and shyness. Shyness is that fear of being judged, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And many, not all introverts are shy, and many people are shy. Some of them are introverts, but plenty of them are extroverts too, which is why the fear of public speaking is so pervasive, you know, because a lot of people have shyness when they get up on a stage and have everybody looking at them.
Now, you have a couple of pieces of advice for parents of helping those kids. What are the main things to keep in mind for a parent that sees, you know, their kid likes to read, likes to be by themselves, they love that alone time, that or that time among small groups of friends, and probably their parents are somewhat like that. What are the best pieces of advice for helping them negotiate school, the social situations of growing up?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, there's so much to say on this, but just to give a couple of high-level tips. You know, the first thing is to obviously honor the child for who they are, and if that's what they like to do, then great. You know, celebrate that and find ways for them to do that. And you do want them to step outside their comfort zone as well, but, you know, to remember that these kids have a longer runway before they take off and fly. So you want to be with them on that long runway. And it's also good to remember that these kids just, they need time to recharge. So if they've been at school all day long, let's say, they probably want to come home and just chill out. And they might be telling you, let's say, I don't like playing soccer, I don't like going to piano lessons or something. And it might be that what they don't like is just being on the go all the time, and that if you gave them the time that they need to recharge, they would be thrilled to do those activities after a while. So it's important to just honor their need for how they like to spend their time.
Yeah, schedule the piano lesson on Saturday.
Exactly, yeah. Or, you know, if there's going to be activities during the week, you know, let them come home for an hour or two and chill out before they go and do those things. And I should say, too, we actually have a website, Quiet Revolution, so it's quietrev.com. So for parents, and also for adults, too, who are interested in these topics, we've got tons of articles and ways to connect, and it's quietrev.com.
All right. Well, Susan, we wish you great success with the new book, Quiet Power. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to be here with you.
Susan Cain is the author of Quiet Power, The Secret Strengths of Introverts, a book for young people, which follows up on her 2012 bestseller, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. For more information about her nonprofit, The Quiet Revolution, visit quietrev.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.